Okay. Chris, I'm just to hedge my bets on the audio. I'm going to record the audio separately here.
Power or just the cable?
I have that too. I just don't know what kind of power you have at that desk.
Spins up, the computer doesn't do anything. The problem could be that only one of the 12 volt.
You still have the question and answer period. Any questions, comments?
Yes.
Requests?
How much you jabber tap dance?
Jabber tap dance.
No, that's not that big of a one.
Okay. I have soft shoes, I can't tap this.
I want to do the dance of the six points. Mr. Six.
Can you put my hats in the index?
I've been to the European Six Flags over Texas.
I've been to the Six Flags over Georgia. There's a special bus.
I wonder how they split the entire theme park up here over to me.
I find it amusing that you call another theme park the Six Flags of Texas when it's not in Texas anymore.
Right, sure.
Because Six Flags is the Six Flags of Texas.
They can usually make Six Flags for anywhere.
No, they can't.
I think he had flags made at Cafe Press.
Thank God Rocky
isn't here.
There
are different Six Flags, but trust me, if you're in New England States, I've easily had Six Flags.
Massachusetts. If you want to plug in, go ahead and plug in. I just put the plug in for the. I'm going to turn the lights, dim the lights a little bit, so they.
That's cool.
Maine used to be part of Massachusetts.
Maine was part of Massachusetts,
yes.
And Nantucket, and Long Island, and Martha's Vineyard alternated between Maine, Massachusetts, and New York. All sorts of excitement.
So
there's a nice little animation out there, one of the genealogy websites, that shows Massachusetts county borders
that's a little dark.
Shifting. From 1620 to present.
Yeah. It's like Boston Connors is in New York because Massachusetts is in New York.
No, not exactly. It moved to New York because the Massachusetts sheriffs couldn't respond over the mountain in a timely fashion at night to suppress illegal boxing matches.
There's a couple dark
coming
things
up like
stagecoach
in New York City. To stage a boxing match in Wattles, Massachusetts. So in order to have the sheriff able to suppress illegal boxing matches, they put themselves under the jurisdiction of New York sheriff.
What's the little corner of Massachusetts that should belong to Kansas?
So somewhere near
Springfield.
It is very near Springfield.
You're talking about the county that was gerrymandered?
He's talking about the Massachusetts little uvula that hangs down towards Hartford.
Okay.
And
does that mean we should blame you for all the gerrymandering, Jerry?
Don't blame me. I was born in Washington State.
Yeah.
Well, that explains everything.
You can hold your breath.
Good. A problem has occurred, a problem in the kernel package.
I didn't write it.
I know you didn't.
Dan, did you write the problem?
No. I've been getting this a little bit at work, because I'm running Fedora as my primary laptop. I don't have Windows anymore.
Does your machine panic and reboot, or just
No,
keep
just
trucking.
It just shows a problem has occurred. Nothing really much. I'll ignore it forever.
Do you have an abort dump that gets created? An ABRT dump that gets created or anything?
No, it just says viewer, ignore or view. Ignore our report.
Okay.
Not a serious problem.
So, what's happening?
See, I have all these wonderful alerts, but that's all evolution and Firefox related.
Yeah. The thing is now, I mean, my system is legal for the IBM network, so it has all these IBM things, including Symantec antivirus, stuff like that.
You have Symantec antivirus on your Fedora machine?
Yes, I do.
Because it's required by the corporate LAN.
And it's scanning for Windows viruses on a Linux.
Probably.
Yeah.
It might notice a browser-infesting Java virus irrespective.
Yeah. I'll probably start the meeting about 7:15. Wait for people to trickle in. I found usually about half people come in between 7 and 7:15. Nobody's on time.
Ooh, that means I can go sneak for candy.
Let's remind on the Addison channel in case anyone's wondering that.
Anybody planning on going to the Cambridge Brewery after the meeting? So it's Shankar, myself, Bill, Jabber, Christoph. Anybody else? Was that six? I didn't count. Couldn't have close enough. I'll take a check before we break. And the clock is wrong.
Oh, yes. Didn't you see it?
I gotta make sure. Don't have anything super special up here.
So we'll remain in the question and answer period. Anybody got any questions, any answers, any barbs or anything? No politics.
Ooh, it's Red Hat 7. Clock.
Looking for an answer, I can tell you the March 24th, the March 31st. You can figure out the question from that.
Okay.
March or May?
I had
get the question right if you can give the answer.
I had Comcast come in to install the new Xfinity One.
There's a security conference at the Nerd Center on the 24th.
That doesn't affect us, except that John and Ron won't be here. They'll be there, but they'll still pay for lunch.
Memorial Day is Monday the 26th.
Okay.
So.
We think the 24th is not a good
one. So the 31st is the best option.
Okay.
Unless some other big conflict on the 31st.
I have this.
In which case, I'd push it to June.
Okay. There's been, actually in the spring, it could conflict with the SAP prep.
monthly meeting over is fourth Wednesday?
Third Wednesday.
Third Wednesday. Third Wednesday, we're usually in building E51, and usually on the third floor. All those rooms were taken, we couldn't get those reserved.
Probably means the parking lot is full.
Parking for this building is invisible.
We used to have some really...
Oh, this building has wonderful parking if you have the right sticker.
Yeah. We had some, we had some nice parking over by building 3 and building 1. Before 9/11, after 9/11, they started to block that off. That's about the time we decided to move D51, which I thought were better classrooms.
Oh, yeah.
Well, 51's been good. How long have we been there? 5 years or more?
Probably close to 10.
Yeah, I know. It's a lot more.
Yeah. I mean, we've been having meetings since for 20 years. And some of it was in building 61.
Anything you want to cut?
Well, Wi-Fi here is not free, right?
Yeah, it is.
Which one would I connect to?
Use MIT.
You have the ones that will chop fingers off, too. Don't tempt me.
It may possibly prompt you to sign up, but it's a free sign-up. Sign up as a guest. Can everybody see the screen with the lights, or should I turn the lights down when we start? Okay, I want to look around there. In the other building, we used to have dimmer switch.
I can see fine. What are we working on? Go join where everybody else is, over at Staples.
Getting discounts on shit is good. If I have to work retail, I'll work whiskey.
You kind of have the Captain Morgan thing on.
Is the north garage open to visitors? Is the north garage open to visitors?
Still there.
Yeah. No longer officially.
Jerry, you put the lights up again?
Yeah. The word I saw on one web page that I thought I emailed to you said that there's... It used to be officially open to visitors.
I'm going to turn it sideways so that the light's not shooting me in the eye.
Tom, I just asked you that. You say not officially. Does that mean he's going to get towed if he parks there?
The square dancers have reported they haven't had problems. I'm not sure how fresh that might be.
What's that, the little lot across?
He's asking about the garage where the flea market is.
Oh, I'm not aware of that garage. So.
That's the one just across the street, Jim.
Okay.
The one where the crossing is. Do you mean the west garage, or do you mean something that's in north campus?
Well, he said north garage, and I actually...
Well, I parked in the garage right behind the Marriott, which is two blocks away.
Yeah, but that's a public garage.
Yeah,
Well, that's why I parked there.
And you have to mortgage your house?
No problem.
He's representing the firm. I'll put it in an expense account. It's a sales mission. It's expensive.
Yep.
Yeah, it's qualified.
I have a Red Hat license.
Hey?
I manage 38 servers, and one of them has to have a license.
Only one?
Yeah, all the others are under a group license. They're for test and internal use only.
Mm-hmm. You know, if the you that's you now were given the you that was you then, that deal, RX, right? Still good?
Well, that sentiment was made 3 years ago when we got to the end of round one.
Yeah.
It's not that easy. There's
oh, yeah, I know. I'm just being flipped. Yeah. It was just, you know.
I mean, the offer that they put on the table for this year was silly.
Yeah,
and they still turned it down.
I have no clue what this year is, but.
Now you're not there anymore, right?
No.
Hello?
I'm making use of a very nice self-placement plan, and I'm going to be putting more of the resume soon.
You should go out to OpenStack and get on board that train. OpenStack World, the OpenStack Summit in Atlanta next month.
Actually, non-sector, I'm glad that Rocky isn't here. We would have had a real big discussion on the Six Flags.
Is he very opinionated on Texas or what?
Whatever gave you that idea.
Mm-hmm.
What did you say that guy's name was? Your guest speaker?
Dan Walsh, sitting behind you.
Well, I suppose, yeah. If you're talking about control groups and containers, bring Dan along makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Dan's been fiddling with the SE Linux sandbox.
Yeah.
And then now the Docker stuff. So he's got a lot more hands-on for Docker containers.
Walsh.
Just like the mayor.
I got Daniel J. Walsh here. At the September 2005 meeting.
Yep.
Been a while.
Long way from Auburn.
So I should correct the calendar to list this meeting as well.
Do you live in Melbourne?
Yeah.
Yeah, I used to work out at the deck out there.
So did we all.
Yeah, we did.
I had a very brief career at deck up in Las Vegas, the other one nearby.
I was in Marlborough, and then we moved to Littleton. And in my cube, if I spilled a couple of these on the floor, you look down and they would move. Because we had so many ants. And that building's now owned by IBM. But they brought the fumigator in during the week, which they never, ever, ever do. Because it was my next door cube mate had spilled a drink. Actually, it was fruit something or other. It didn't clean up after himself. You might know him, Wayne Corelli. He's still with HP.
That sounds like a great Dilbert cartoon or something from Office Space.
Yeah, but it was. So you'll see if I eat potato sticks at my desk, you'll see me on my hands and knees cleaning them up because of that. But our building is a little bit cleaner. Marlborough had mice. whole families of mice, and they got it to Clem Coles, a former speaker from here. They got it to his candy one time, in a locked drawer, and a locked office, not that that matters. No. I had peanuts, and I had peanut shells in the wastebasket, and a mouse got into the wastebasket, and that's where they caught him. Frank Ziong had peanuts, and they got into his peanuts. And Frank is one of the cleaner people around. He's very, very clean, and they got him. That was very comical.
I remember several cases in Marlboro at Fidelity.
Yeah.
Sitting in the meeting conference rooms, a little mouse would come out in the window shelf.
Yeah.
Crawl down the other side and go back underneath the...
Yeah, they told me there were mice or worse at World Trade, but I never saw them as far out on the wharf as I was.
Yeah. Well, they were...
They must have all been closer to the cafeteria.
Yeah, in those buildings, they were all deck employees. We used to have some deck employees used to sleep in their cubes.
Touche. Touche. My boss actually used to work in there. Does Dave Horan name ring a bell?
Excuse me, Dave?
Dave Horan? No?
No.
Yeah, he's a kind of networking guy. So
yeah. Well, it's really the guy that I'm making fun of was a networking guy. Big heavy guy. His name was Dave.
KK Krishna. Well, there are a lot of people actually work there. But you're working on the kind of computing side of the deck or the networking side of the deck? I know there are a lot of
I was compilers. Mm-hmm. I know most of the compiler guys at deck. Now I was Linux, or I was Unix compiler. And we were having a big fight with the VMS guys. They were developing a new C compiler called DECC, and they wanted to get us to use it on the Unix side. But the advantage of DECC is that we were actually paying a royalty to MIPS, or Silicon Graphics, because we're using their compilation system. And that was actually, for me, it was a good thing because I co-wrote the assembler for Digital Unix, which became True64. I wrote it for Windows NT. Because by putting that on Windows NT, we eliminate the royalty because NT was not using our legacy compilation system. They were actually using the Microsoft C front end with a DEC back end.
So that used to have a language called Bliss.
Yep.
Yeah. You know anything about that?
As little as possible.
Yeah.
I've written a few lines of code in it. I've had to debug a couple of Bliss things, but not much.
Ignorance is bliss. Ignorance is bliss. Yes, very much.
Very good.
That's like the apocryphal saying about test instruments, if it works, it's a fluke.
Yeah. Well, I was saying, I bought Jabber. I got ordered Xfinity, the new Xfinity 101s. It's going to save me $20 a month. And
is that like fiber?
The guy came in. It's a single DVR with up to three remote boxes in your house.
Oh, it's just a television, not it?
Yeah, and you can record up to five shows at once. But it's still, with the introductory rate, it saves me a whole bunch. But the guy came in and says, "Oh, your cable's in the machine." He says, They can't use copper shielded cables. They want quad shielded cables. So I called an electrician to come in. The cable guy gave me a whole case of cable. So.
Can you pull the videos on the computer, or is it just locked up in the DVR?
They're locked up on the DVR, as far as I know. You probably can, but you can through.
For me, that would be a showstopper.
But you can through Comcast Stream, so you get them anyway. You can load them from Comcast onto your computer directly if you're a subscriber.
To record or just to play? Because you said stream, which kind of suggests play only.
Yeah, you can record. Let's play.
I wrote my own media manager last week.
Now, if I'm watching TV, I like to sit back in a lounge chair and watch a big screen.
Well, that's not too bad with this.
Okay, are you ready?
Sure.
Okay, we're about ready to start. And for everybody who doesn't know, this is Christoph Dorbeck. Christoph does our Linux soup presentations once a year. He says he works for Red Hat.
Think so. Still do.
He gets paid by Red Hat. Work, I don't know. And we also have a guest speaker, Dan Walsh. And Christoph will introduce Dan. Actually, Dan spoke here about 10 years ago. So, when he had a little bit more hair, too.
Yeah.
Do you have like old pictures, long hair, rock star? All right.
Okay.
We good?
All right. Lights are okay. Should we turn them down?
I think the flash green is fine from here.
I'm being asked to turn them down a little bit. They wash out the screen a little bit. These don't have.
It's not that bad. And when you turn it, when you make it dark like you did before, the video looks like crap when it goes up to YouTube.
Well, let's see. Can you see?
That's way too dark.
Go middle.
That's better.
Okay. That's where we were.
That's what it was. Can you stop in between?
You can't stop it in between where you had it just a minute ago? Like if you hit one of the middle buttons?
Yeah, here's one.
That's too dark.
Yeah.
All right.
These are discrete buttons. They're not slider switches like we had in the other.
Just take a hoodie and throw them over one or two lamps. Fire department come out and tell us not to. All right. Welcome. Thanks for having me out again. Quick survey. Who's familiar with traditional virtualization like VMware or KVM? Great. Who's using KVM today?
I got to switch between my monitor and my keyboard.
has anybody played with Linux container technology? A little bit on the background. All right. So I'm due to present on this type of material in a couple of weeks at the Red Hat Summit, so you kind of get a preview of some of the slide work that I'm working on. A lot of it's rough, but let's discuss containers. Okay, so Fedora users, just in the front, Ubuntu, CentOS. Other?
Red Hat.
Well, Red Hat. Are you using Red Hat on your portable laptop?
No, actually,
I'm putting this. Okay. Does anybody else here work for Red Hat besides me and Dan? Do we have any spies in the crowd? All right. I can't talk about release dates or anything like that related to RHEL 7. There's still a lot of stuff that's in flux. Obviously, anything that's upstream, like things that are being developed in Fedora, we can talk about. That's what we're going to be sharing here today. One of the key things in RHEL 7, or now in Fedora, when did containers show up in Fedora? Was that 18, 19, when LXE kind of, do you know? That doesn't matter.
I'm sorry.
So. Yeah. And that was, Liberate Out at Sea also showed up in REL 6 as a tech preview, I think in 6.3 or 6.4. Okay. So among the other things in REL 7 that's of significant interest, containers is probably the one technology that's creating a lot of market buzz. And that's because it enables another type of virtualization. So virtualization is called containers. They've been referred to as application containers, and some people refer to it as Docker containers. Docker is a particular technology that implements all kinds of parts of the Linux kernel, Linux operating system, to create containers and get them to run. We'll let Dan talk about that specifically in the second half today. He's actually going to provide some live demo of container stuff. But when you compare a container to traditional virtualization, I'm going to jump slides here. In traditional virtualization, you basically abstract the operating system away from a piece of hardware. So through software emulation, the virtualization technology advertised a generic CPU, generic network interface, a generic storage interface, and then as long as the software had enough device drivers to support what was being advertised as an interface, then it could run in that virtualized environment. So early on in the VMware days, right, you had the VMware days, you had the bus logic SCSI driver was like the initial disk interface there. Over time, they've now come up with their own. And so you basically had the operating system talking to a software stack, completely abstracted away from the fact that it wasn't really hardware, it was all software. This provided great isolation, so you can install multiple operating systems on a single piece of hardware. You can install different versions of the same software on the same hardware, so RHEL 4, RHEL 5, RHEL 6, you can mix it up. And then arguably you had better security because everything from the operating system down was isolated and basically wrapped in this emulation layer. And then over time you got all these other cool features like vMotion, right? You want to take a virtual machine that's running on this server and you want to have it move to another server without shutting the VM down. Therefore, you can upgrade the firmware, replace hard drives or whatever on this piece of equipment, but the applications never went offline. So you have live migration, live storage migration, and all these other features that VMware and KVM and Red Hat virtualization provide that basically built on top of traditional vert. Yeah.
Does that compete with like ESX?
Yes. So when I speak of VMware, I'm talking specifically of ESX. vCenter.
Yep.
So where vCenter is kind of the single pane of glass, that console that allows you to manage, I don't know, what is it, up to like 60 some odd ESX hosts.
Yep.
And then once you go beyond that, then you have to get another vCenter, and then you get more. So basically create these compute, I don't want to use the term cloud because that's not right, cluster. You could create an ESX cluster. So Red Hat virtualization is much the same way. When you say ESX, Red Hat virtualization would be RHEL with enabled KVM. And then once you stand up those hosts, you want to have some kind of a management console, then you would run the Red Hat Enterprise Virtualization Manager. And that creates the GUI with all the, let me live migrate everything, point and click kind of stuff. But containers, on the other hand, instead of extracting the operating system away from the hardware, containers abstract applications away from the operating system. So if you go a level higher, when your applications interact with the OS, it looks for things like, an IP address. It looks to interact with mount points in the file system. And if you can take those things away that make the operating system unique, now you can run multiple applications on the same host without the penalty of running in a fully virtualized environment. And that penalty is performance and scalability. So, back to this other slide. Let me go here. This will make it more natural. So, when you deal with container technology, there's basically four key challenges that you have to look at. Resource management, right? So if you're gonna have applications running in containers, you need to be able to control how much CPU, network, disk IO, particular container can consume from the host. You need to look at process isolation. A lot of this plays into security or other resource management aspects so that, one program can't do a PSCF and get all the process IDs of everything running on the host because now that program is no longer isolated. It has visibility into the rest of the operating system. So you need to pick pieces of the OS, isolate those things. Then, of course, there's the real security, which we've implemented with SE Linux. And then you need some kind of a convenient management tool that puts all these different aspects of the operating system together and then allows you to use containers in a nice, easy way, the same way you use today's virtualization. So as Dan mentioned, you know, parts of Linux containers and parts of what we call the kernel namespaces have been showing up in Linux over quite a while. Some people would argue LXC has been around for a long time, but there's a lot of these puzzle pieces that LXC doesn't implement. Therefore, the whole container story is not really there yet. But with RHEL 7, Fedora 20, name your upstream community, you know, everything's kind of migrating to these sets of technologies now. Talking about C groups is a resource management capability that was introduced in RHEL 6. Basically allows you to lump processes and threads into groups and then dictate percentage of CPU, percentage of network I/O, disk I/O, and memory that your particular groups can consume. So if you think of installing multiple Oracle databases on a single host, it's great because now you don't have to pay the licensing fees, but if you want to put your development and production Oracle databases together on the same machine, you're always worried that your development guys are going to consume all your resources, right? They're going to put more disk I/O, use up more memory, whatever. But with C groups, you can basically implement two Oracle servers on the same box, constrain one to use minimum resources, and the production one always gets what's been guaranteed to it. So that's the idea of what C groups is going to provide you. The kernel namespaces and this process isolation, there's six of these various namespaces, five of which were delivered in RHEL 6.5. The last one, which is the user space, user namespace, won't be delivered until RHEL 7. So depending on what you want to do with containers, there's a lot you can do with the core plumbing that exists today. But if you want to get to the Docker story that really wraps everything up in a nice user interface, then you have to wait for RHEL 7 to come out. SE Linux we'll cover, and the libvirt, LXC, and the Docker. So libvirt is a virtualization API. It was developed to basically provide an abstracted API layer so that as Red Hat initially in RHEL 5, we were investing in Xen technologies as the core of virtualization. But already then, we brought it to market with the libvirt API kind of wedged between. So you weren't using Xen commands to manage. You were using libvirt commands, like the vir shell, et cetera. And so the container model is being adapted as a plugin to libvirt. So that's going to happen in conjunction with Docker. That's also going to show up in RHEL 7 as well. OK, so back up to. Why containers? Hey.
Your fellow Texan.
You missed the Texas story earlier. We were debating the Six Flags of Texas.
You want to do it again?
We can rehash it at the pub later.
Thank you, Steve.
So why containers? I mean, container technology in one form or another has existed in other operating systems for a while. If you're familiar with Solaris Zones. There was another Linux-based container technology. What was it called?
IBM is LFCI. IBM has, I think it's LFCI, which
NAIX.
It actually runs on the vCert, but it can run on Z Linux.
Okay. Got down. What'd you say it was called?
It's LFCI, I believe. Let me look it up real quick. I was looking at that today for
IBM developed LFC tools.
Yeah, right.
LFC tools is tool set for enabling all the things
that Virtuoso? No. Something with a V. Oh, well.
OpenVZ.
OpenVZ. That's exactly what it was. Thank you. So similar kinds of technologies to implement and run containers. And the reason they're interesting, because all your applications that run a container run on the same kernel that's running the host. So you don't pay the virtualization penalty of performance. So in essence, you don't have to worry about starting and shutting down an operating system when you launch containers. So container start time could be, you know, seconds versus lots of seconds.
You're described as a true environment on steroids.
Can be, yep. And as we kind of talk about the namespaces, that'll explain. I'm going to do a lot of hand waving because I don't have those slides made yet. But essentially, I mean, what John just mentioned is, everybody familiar with Chroot? Anybody not familiar with Chroot? No. The idea of Chroot is, let's say you run an FTP server. FTP server is usually considered one of those insecure things that's easily attacked. And so if you can contain that server in what's called a Chrooted environment, you run a command and it basically puts FTP and all the binaries it refers to into a separate directory. And then anything running from that FTP server can only work within that file system. So if somebody attacks the FTP server and can get out, basically get to a shell, the only things they can attack are things that are installed inside that Chrooted environment. So containers are much the same way. You're taking an application and you're Chrooting it into namespaces now, where you're basically isolating it from more than just the file system. But you're also allowing it to have a shared piece of the operating system. It gets to use the same kernel, you can share different mount points, you can share file systems and libraries and all the things from the operating system, and then you can overlay, you know, basically as you build the container, you can overlay components of the operating system. So if you set up an HTTP server and you wanted it to have its own var temp directory, you can embed var temp in the container, and then it would overlay essentially what the operating system provides. So then this brings up the concept of, well, how much do you want to share with the operating system? If in the container you want to share everything with the OS, so that you basically have that model of, I'm going to patch the operating system once, and now all my containers will automatically be patched. This is, I think Solaris used the term the root zone. So if you patch the root zone, and then all of the other Solaris zones use that same root zone, then all the containers automatically get patched. But the problem is, if you patch the root zone, you have to take all your applications offline because you're patching one area and you have to reboot everything. So you have this dilemma. Do you share everything and get the advantages of, you know, I only have to patch things once, I only have to deploy one package in one place, but now my 10 virtual machines, my 10 containers can use them all? Or do I want to have the applications have more autonomy, like traditional virtualization, and basically bundle an entire operating system in the container along with the application? And now when I deploy my app, I'm basically deploying an entire stack of RHEL minus the kernel with the application as a container, and then it gets mounted up and run. Depending on your environment, that you can have the argument both ways. Operations people usually don't like containers because it means now that, you know, containers typically mean I'm scaling up. I'm going to run 1,000 applications on a single machine. And if I've got a container installed in here, that's potentially having to patch 1,000 different machines. Yep.
So what's the meaning of application? Could it be a complete, say, LAMP stack with the web application that runs on it?
Yep. It can.
Would that be a typical thing to do, or is that more than typical?
I think the intent, especially behind like a Docker container, is to build everything that delivers a particular service in that. Are we using the term gear for that, or what are we? Still calling it a container? OpenShift calls it a gear. No, but
in Docker terms, Docker likes, guys who are developing Docker want individual services of each container. So they would say that LAMP stack, you would have one for your web server, one for your database, one for your middleware.
Oh.
You would have multiple. Now, that being said, there's no problem with doing them all in the same container.
containers then can talk to each other properly. So
yeah,
like a web server container, an application server container, a database.
The standard way people are getting containers to tie together now is open network, though. So but it'd be over a local network. So so you open up ports on certain machines inside a virtual network on the machine.
In performance terms, is that like a Unix pipe?
Yeah, I mean, similar. It's close to a Unix pipe, as far as speed. But yeah, that's one of the ideas. But other people are building, people have built all the way up to full booting operating systems inside containers. So not that I suggest that you should do that.
All right, so I can play it either way.
Yeah,
I can split my stack into components.
Right. We built a tool, a Woodbird sandbox, that kind of is running in system D and mid system inside of the container. This system would launch individual certs inside of the container. And we're planning on doing something similar to Docker. Right now, Docker is more about running a single cert, single Apache service inside of the container, single Apache.
Yeah.
Basically, my understanding is a kind of lightweight VM, and then you can kind of get like more finer grain of resource control, right?
Yes.
Like how finer is it? Like for example, CPU, like VM, you can assign like number of like cores, you want to assign to VM and things like that, right? So, like in container, do they have even finer grain already, like, or?
So where is your experience, what's your practical experience with assigning cores to a virtual machine today? Is it VMware? Or do you have KVM based?
The KVM, yes. Okay. Yeah.
So even today, because KVM is basically a single process running on a host, you can apply cgroup policies to a KVM virtual machine. So with some planning, you can take your virtual machines, pin them to CPUs, whatever, and then use C groups to further divide how one VM could starve another VM from service, for example.
Like I would say, like 20% of CPU resources is container use, and then
Right.
Can you do that? Like even what about the network? Like, can you even utilize network
that? So when I kind of finish with this, I'm going to do some demo stuff. I'm going to cover CPU, network, and disk for C groups. And then when I'm done with that, he's going to do Docker and talk about containers some more. Any other questions? No. Okay, so we covered that. Okay, so basic use cases, I mean, we've kind of already covered already, like you mentioned, resource constraints, you want to stop MariaDB or MySQL from using all the system memory. Private file systems, you want one container to have a different file system than the standard host file system. Private networking, basically prevent an app from getting off the host. Security confinement. And then as you move into the cases with RHEL 7, the sys5 init process upstart is being replaced with systemd, and the goal is to have systemd basically manage all the containers and cgroup policies. So basically you'll have one choke point that basically runs the entire box, and then there'll be APIs and command line tools to basically operate through systemd to reallocate and repurpose your resources. And here examples. I'm going to run multiple instances of JBoss or a couple of different versions of PostgreSQL, but with different configs in place. Okay, so we talked about that. We covered this. And just out of curiosity, is the fonts and stuff in the boxes, is that okay to read in the back, or is that too small?
Too small.
Too small. All right.
Yeah, memory is kind of getting small here, but plausible.
But you can see this, well, it's also out of focus, but the C groups, those fonts, those are okay. Kernel namespaces, stuff's in bold. Right.
Yeah, bold is
okay. All right, that's my font test. Okay, let's jump out of slides and talk more about reality here. Okay, so I am leveraging hate doing this, but I'm going to go full screen and hopefully I can come back from it. Okay. So I have here a, am I 32-bit or 64-bit? I have a 32-bit RHEL 6.4 virtual machine running in KVM. I'm using the SPICE VDI utilities to basically get the console to mine doing full screen. The only reason this is 32-bit is because I keep this in my back pocket from whenever somebody says, hey, I need you to run a WebEx. And WebEx doesn't play nice with 64-bit Java. So that's why I'm using 32-bit. Otherwise, everything's 64-bit, 32-bit compatible. Okay, I've got three shells, one of which I'm root, but I can get out of that. And just I just do a sudo su dash. And what I'm going to do in the interest of not having to type everything, I have my little cheat sheet of commands. Okay, so the focus right now is C groups. So everything obviously here is RHEL 6. C groups is still around in RHEL 7. A little bit different implementation because it's going to be commanded through systemd. Are the C group command line utilities going to be the same?
You can still use these existing C group tools. The preferred method is systemd.
Okay. So obviously the objective is here's things you can play with and use today. All right, so my objective now is I want to basically implement some network policies and find some means to test the network policy and show that there is some difference in the changes that you make. And so I'm going to create a C group. Well, first I'm going to clear it. So there's a command called cg clear. Make sure everything's cleared off, and I'm going to clean my network traffic control queue as well. So he's clear. All right, C group, online utilities, nothing there. All right. C groups are implemented in a virtual file system, much like FlashProc. So you have command line utilities that work through libc group to create things. You can use commands like cg group, or you can use traditional file system commands like makedir and echo parameters into the files to basically create your C groups. I'm going to use the latter set where I'm just going to make dirs and create things this way. So you'll see here, this is what the C group file system looks like when it's first set up. And if I'm using the right terminology, we call these various subsystems within C groups. So they look like mount points. And then I'll pick these mount points and I'll mount them over to my my resource that I create. So essentially, I'll create a C group hierarchy and then mount the subsystems to that. Therefore, basically, now if I created other hierarchies, am I using the right terminology for that? When I create my hierarchy, yeah, close enough. You can't use the various resources in multiple places. So there are some things you have to understand about how you can set up these things. So you can't just go crazy and arbitrarily make stuff. There's rules in place of how you can reuse resources in various hierarchies. So first step, I'm going to create this test 01. It's already there. Let's do this. We'll start from scratch. And is this okay size-wise, or do I need to bump it up a little?
That's good.
Is that better? Okay. And I'm also going to get rid of color, because color is not my friend. Better? Okay. Anybody else colorblind besides me? Okay. So if there's something in red and I'm ignoring it, you'll know why. All right. So make directory test 01. All right. So this creates basically the root of my C group hierarchy. And the only thing that I'm going to leverage is this net CLS subsystem. And so basically use the mount command. And I'm going to, when I finish this documentation, it'll all get published. I mean, I have to present this at the summit, and it'll all be in there. And the documentation from the summit is always available for people to download. All right, so I create the mount point. And now I'm going to create a I don't know what we call this. So within that C group, I'm now creating a name of a group and I'm going to assign the tasks that I run into this group, and then I'm going to basically throttle this particular group so that it performs a specific way. All right, so now that that's done, this is the only piece of magic that took me a while to figure out what to do here. So, all right, so what NetCLS does is it basically adds a tag to all the network traffic that comes in and out of the processes that are running within the C group. That tag can then be inspected by TC, which is the normal traffic shaping utilities that Linux provides. And so once that tag shows up and TC can grab it, then you can implement, you know, TC type parameters to dictate traffic flow. So this parameter creates this tag, and this is a hexadecimal value, and had to look it up online, but if you must know, you'll see here in a second what that correlates to. All right, so this is the command to clear my TC queuing disciplines. All right, lots of values in here that I don't necessarily understand. HTTP, I think, is the high traffic bucket or something along those lines.
Hierarchical.
The what?
Hierarchical.
The hierarchical traffic bucket, okay. Then I create the class. And you'll notice at the end here, I've scrolled off the edge, but basically I'm setting a rate of 500 bits per second. And then the last thing to do is to attach a filter. And so that sets up that policy. All right. So now the trick is, well, great, I've got the C group set up. How do I get my processes to run within there? So this is actually pretty straightforward. I could either use a command like cgexec, where I can cgexec, pass a couple of parameters, and then specify the command that I want to run. And then basically cgexec takes care of setting up and getting the C group and all the processes isolated. I'm going to do it a little bit different because this, I think, explains it better. Everybody knows dollar dollar, if I echo dollar dollar? I'll enlarge this in just a second, but that's basically giving me the process ID of my shell, which is 2241. So now here, I'm going to go into my test01. You'll see here is a file called tasks, like cat tasks. There's nothing in it. So I'm going to echo 2241 into my tasks. All right. So here's my test. I have two shells, one shell which I have now supposedly constrained in my C groups, and one shell which I haven't. So let's play with the shell that I haven't yet. I basically put this into a command. And so what this command's doing is basically just running an SSH to my host. So remind you, remember, this machine that we're playing on is a virtual machine that's running in KVM. And I'm now using C groups within the VM. And that machine is basically going to my host to retrieve a file. So I'm basically just using SCP to grab something over the virtualized network. Notice that it's dragging pretty slow and that, you know, it's going to take, what, 13, 15 minutes to pull everything over. So I'm going to run into my other shell here and run the exact same command. And I'll show you the output of, I'll show you the contents of this command just a second, just so you can see it's doing an SCP. And so basically he's almost running at full speed. Same command, two different shells. One's dragging forever, the other one's just going to crank right along. And it takes about 15, 20 seconds for it to finish. So now, if you want to go back and change, you know, the throughput rate, there's another TC command that allows me to do that. Basically, here's the change parameter. I'm changing my rate to 1 megabit. I'm going to let him finish just to show that he's going to be done. You know what? We can squeeze him down a little bit. All right, so he's finished. And I can come over here and change his throughput rate. And just basically watch that he's going to almost jump back into the megabit range almost instantly. And of course, if I like flip them up to 10 megabits or something like that, then it'll crank away. Something else that's interesting to do. Anybody familiar with the iPerf utility? So iPerf is a great little utility for measuring network bandwidth. The only things that fall into question then, you know, is where's the performance penalty being incurred the most? You know, is it file system buffer cache? Is it the network stack? So as we do different tests, we have to make sure we clear the buffer cache, et cetera, to make sure that we're not benefiting unfairly in getting invalid results. All right, so he's done up there. So everybody happy that we've shown that we can control network throughput with C groups. This has nothing to do with containers. This is simple C groups, and I've contained everything that runs. So anything in the top shell that'll execute, if I create new child processes or whatever, everybody inherits the same C groups. So in fact, when I go run this command, if I cat my tasks, you'll see that my original shell process is still there. If I go run the command and now cat tasks again, you'll see that the other process IDs for the other things that spun off are also contained within the same C group. Which brings up the point that you can certainly go in now and manipulate and remove things out of there. So if something spun up and you want to pull something out of a C group and return it back to the regular pool, you can do that. Just simple stuff. All right. Okay. So now let's go do this. Let's play with iPerf. So iPerf is a utility. It's not part of RHEL, but it's available in the EPEL repo, E-P-E-L. Who's familiar or not familiar with the EPEL repo? So standard RHEL, you connect to Red Hat, you can get all the supplementary, the Red Hat channels, all the other stuff. EPEL is a separate repo. It's part of the Fedora distribution. And basically, it's where Red Hat engineers repurpose and repackage some technologies into RPMs that fit cleanly on Red Hat Enterprise Linux. So there's an EPEL repo for RHEL 5, there's an EPEL repo for RHEL 6, and you can find great utilities like iPerf available in there. These aren't things that you could call Red Hat for support for because they're community projects. They're just rebuilt for Red Hat Enterprise Linux. But most of these projects are developed and run by Red Hat employees, so usually if you just go to the community and say, I've got a bug, they usually get fixed pretty quick. Okay, so in the iPerf world, I need a shell. You have to have a server and a client.
I want to mention that iPerf is available for other operating systems as well.
Okay. You mean like?
Windows and OS X and Solaris. Multi-platform.
Okay, so this is not very interesting, but I'll enlarge it just when I run it here. So iPerf, so you basically run iPerf-S, sets up the server. All right, and I'm going to shrink him back out of the way. And then I'm going to come down here, and I'm going to run the iPerf client. iPerf-C, yeah, let's go ahead and make him bigger. And basically he runs a throughput test. You can see that the connection came in on this side. It's going to send a bunch of packets back and forth and say, woohoo, you've got this much throughput. And the throughput between like RHEL 6 and RHEL 7 is much better on RHEL 7. So you'll see certain tests that we do with RHEL 7 actually perform better. Okay, so bandwidth, 10 gigabits per second. Let's go run the same test up here. Let's see. 12 megs. What did I set this last guy to? Wait a minute. Now's the part of the presentation where I get confused on which server I'm doing things. All right, so I did actually set it up to 10 megabits, so let's throttle this guy back down to 1. It wasn't a fair test. So hopefully it comes back and it says I've got, you know, roughly 1 megabit throughput. So it's just another way of validating that the changes that we're implementing through TC actually work. All right. So that's that test. Any more questions on networking? And this, again, this will all be published. And the stuff that I found online didn't all seem that, well, coherent. So it took me a little while to get this working.
So you can also block certain ports or certain addresses as well using TC and similar things, or just do flow rate control?
I'm not that familiar with TC. You're shaking your head yes? No? So blocking ports and stuff, I would probably rely on IP tables.
Okay.
The traditional.
Do you attach an IP table to a C group then?
No.
Okay.
No, so it's system-wide. Everything that comes in, IP tables, is basically the front door. And then once it gets into the door, then basically TC implements the queuing disciplines for the flow control.
If you wanted to have different rules for what processes on the system based on IP tables rules, you can do that through using the network namespace if you wanted.
And so you actually network interfaces?
You can have with network namespace, you can actually have totally different IP addresses.
Okay.
In some cases, you can also admit the network altogether, so it crosses before you can see the network process.
Okay.
Well, that raises a question about containers. If I've got a web container, an application server, a database server container, do they have different IP addresses?
They can.
They can.
One of the things that you didn't really cover was you have the choice of if containers is first of all, there's no such thing from a Linux kernel point of view, there's no such thing as a container. So with what I see you showing in this talk, there was three different sort of key components to what people think build up containers. And those are C groups for resource management. So one of your processes, which is showing right now, to be behave differently, or you can somehow contain based on resource utilization. That's what C groups is. Secondary part is security confinement, which is what legacy Linux does. And then the third component is a thing called namespaces. Namespaces are, there's five namespaces we're taking advantage of right now. There's actually a sixth one coming along. But the five namespaces are IPC namespaces, which allow you to have different 7-4 memory allocations per process. So you can have, say, shared memory segmented in different containers. Not really be the same. Process namespace, which is basically everybody has their own slash proc. You can't see a process on the system. There's processes inside that namespace. Network namespace, which is the full networking stack. You have IP tables, rules, routing tables, everything. Mount namespace, you have a totally different way of looking at the system for what's mounted. So I can have a slash temp, you can have a slash temp, and then do totally different things. On the case of Docker containers, the entire operating system from slash down is different for each container. And then there's also one called UTS namespace, which allows you to have different host names. So processes can have different host names in the system. The sixth namespace is not currently, well, it's allowed in Rawhide, Fedora Rawhide. I think a bunch of mine have turned it on right now. It's called user namespace. User namespace allows you to have this different UI, have the same UIDs in different processes, and those UIDs are actually different. So inside of the namespace, you could have a UID 0 that isn't really UID 0, but you would be root. You would have root controls of your namespace, but not have root control of the system. The problem with that namespace is that it just came out last summer, and it's really, from a RHEL point of view, a RHEL 7 point of view, we're a little worried about turning it on right now. We want to let it bake a little while longer. And in future RHEL, Future L7 at least, you're probably going to turn it on, so we can do some things.
Did that answer your question? Or just confuse you more?
I'm getting there. I'm interested in just that question about whether you can say in my web container, can only take traffic that comes in on port 18443. and my database can only take traffic on 3306.
Yeah, what you can do is you can, in your container, you would set up a network namespace, and then you would relay those ports into your container. So those containers would not even have access to the real Ethernet on your box, and you would then set up the port 80 to be relayed to this container and port. Database port will be relayed into the other container. But those inside of the container, they wouldn't even have access to the Rails, to the Rails network.
So that's what software firewall is.
It's like it's on our relay, basically it's being relayed into the container. It's very simple. I mean, you can do the same thing with Russian cheese. So
the container only sees what is relayed.
Right. Only packets that I can come into.
How do I set up relays? What are the software tools?
That's what the management tools are.
Docker tool.
That's what libvirt, LXC, and Docker are going to be doing. Is that they take all that, how do I set all the stuff up and give you a nice, convenient way to do it?
Do you know what the underlying technology that those tools use? Is it using a global virtual LAN?
It's actually, I think the network relays is actually taking advantage of the table, so you can set up relay rules.
Okay.
Yeah, but just to kind of restate what I said before, traditional virtualization abstracted an operating system away from the hardware. Here you're taking your application and you're abstracting it away from the operating system. So all those things that made the operating system unique, like IP, hostname, all the things that he mentions, mount points, the application has a different set of visors on when it looks at the operating system. And so that's what the namespaces provide, is this different set of visors so that you can have two databases, both thinking that they have exclusive access to the operating system when they're actually working in a virtualized application container. Just taking it one level higher. And when it gets really interesting, I mean, the reason this technology is really interesting is because as we move into cloud computing, if you look at like Amazon, the EC2 cloud, right? That's more like traditional virtualization with like heavily automated tools that they've built. So when you swipe your credit card and you say, I want a large Amazon EC2 instance, they spin up a virtual machine much like KVM. Well, they're using Xen and KVM technologies today. I don't think that's any kind of secret. So they spin up a virtual machine. You can ask for RHEL. You get Red Hat Enterprise Linux in there. Well, if you install Red Hat Enterprise Linux 6 into this virtual machine that's running in Amazon, then you can further subdivide the resources using containers. Because containers is strictly a software technology that runs within the kernel, now you can leverage containers and basically, you know, if you're installing 1,000 developers onto a single machine, everybody works at different times. That's like the perfect use case of, wow, let's use a container. And I know this guy uses more of the equipment than this guy does, so I'll create a C group that basically makes sure that his utilization of the host doesn't unfairly attack everybody else. And you can actually now, with containers, provide SLA, and yet even better, continue to use traditional virtualization, so you get all those other benefits of hardware consolidation, abstraction, and vMotion, and all the redundancy options that already exist, right? So containers isn't a containers versus traditional vert kind of argument. It's you can do both. All right, back to a quick demo on C groups, and then I think we want to talk more about Docker because it seems to be more container stuff. Okay, so now I'm going to do a quick demonstration of some disk I/O stuff. So CG clear, and it's already all gone. All right, so now I'm going to create test 2. I'm going to use the block IO subsystem. And if I go to C groups, test 2, see a bunch of parameters in here. In the same way, I'm going to create a directory here called throttled. So now if I cd throttled, all right, so this creates my base hierarchy, and now it's just a means of me to once again constrain my process up here. So echo $$, $22.41, echo $22.41 into tasks. All right. So finally, what was the magic here? Okay, so here's the, again, I had to go to the internet and do a bunch of reading to figure out what the magic incantation is this way. And I'll just, what's the easiest way to blow up this guy? That's a font change. All right, so the parameters here that you enter is I'm going to, I might as well just put them in here so you can see it. So the parameters you enter is the major number, minor number, and this is the major number, minor number for my disk. So if I do an ls-ll slash dev bda, since this is a virtual disk, you'll see my major minor numbers are 252 and 0. So basically I've created a C group that's going to restrict access to the entire disk. You can do it by partition, whatever, because the major minor numbers will change for each partition. But for the purposes of today's example, I'm just saying anything that's going to run out of that shell is going to have a reduced throughput rate to that particular drive. All right. So now let's run our test. And just to make sure my test is fair, I'm going to basically echo value 3 into proxys VM drop, and that's going to basically clear all the page caches, the inode caches, etc. Just make sure that... And what did I do? Drop caches. Copy the whole thing. Mistake. Save. All right, now that that's done, I can go to test one. Alright, so dd, this is a pretty straightforward thing. I'm just going to do, what did I do here? Input file equals slash dev bda, input file equals slash dev slash null, block size equals, I'll just do 1 meg, I'm going to count 5. Pretty simple test. Everybody familiar with dd? Just going to read stuff from a file. So I'm going to read from the top of my disk. I'm going to not care about writing it anywhere. I'm discarding it to dev null. Set my block size to 1 meg, and I'm going to count for 5. And I don't have permission. All right, how did this work before? Oh, yeah. Did I just do that?
Turn out the spam.
Alright, I'm obviously going to have to go back and rework my sampler because this worked before. How do I do different here? Yeah, I know, but I don't think I went to root for this window, and I know I didn't change the parameters, so I did a test a little bit differently. But I know it was working.
Are you reading all of slash?
Well, he's reading.
No, I'm just reading the first 5 megs of a disk from VDA.
Yeah,
I know, which makes me wonder what my test was earlier today when I verified that this was working. All right, let's run the test from the non. But basically, even my sudo should now be, let's can't find out. Yeah, so I've done my sudo to root shell, so then the root shell should also be within the C group.
So when you exit that process, the ID will disappear from the test file?
Yes. All right, so this is the non-constrained one. Oh, wait, I got to drop my caches. Okay. All right, so it's still working. So, okay, I must have done the su to root before. So basically, I ran it up top, and it took but 12 seconds to execute and run it down at the bottom, and it took roughly less than a second, so almost 0.08. And I can change the throughput rate. Notice that I set it to, this is IOPS per second, or IOs per second, and I can, if I reduce it further, it'll take forever. And I set both the read and write, even though I'm not writing anything, so this really wouldn't make a difference. But now if I change this value and go rerun the test, let me make sure I drop my cache. Come on. Everybody know Control R for Bash?
Recall.
So if you're on the shell and you, and you hit Control R, then you can.
So it's like search reverse.
Right. In the old K shell, you used to do the escape V, and then you do VI commits. Okay, so now we rerun this after I've dropped my caches. Should be a little bit quicker, but still not as fast. So about double. All right, so we can kind of show the block IO is doing what it's supposed to do. Okay, last demo. CG clear.
So you control bandwidth to a particular block device, not totally independent of file systems.
Correct. So the block IO parameters are major minor numbers.
Okay.
Of a device.
If you're built up, if you're using the MD driver, where you built up a RAID thing out of underlying actual hardware I/O.
So the MD device, that gets a major minor number in the dev file system, I believe.
So you could restrict at that level. If you did something really strange and you restricted performance on one of the underlying hardware devices, but you mounted the file system on the MD device, do you have any idea whether you would still restricted access to I/O that went to that disk from a container? Restrained process, or has it been filtered through by going through the MD device, so it's no longer visible?
You lost me.
No clue.
All right, no one will want to do it anyway. But
yeah.
If you have an MD device, it's like a RAID 1 that has two underlying hardware devices, and I put an IO restriction on one of those two hardware devices, but I'm accessing it through the MD device block. Device number, it would seem to me it may not be visible that a process is accessing it through the MD device should be restricted when it goes to one of those two underlying hardware devices.
All right, so if I understand what you're saying, you set up a C group policy that says my process can't write fast to dev A.
Yeah.
But you do it at that level, but when the process is actually running, he's interacting with the MD device. Which
happens to use Dev A as one of its underlying storage devices.
No, I don't know.
That seems like you wouldn't really get that restriction because then it's the kernel moderating for you.
I would think it probably wouldn't happen, but yeah. I was just curious.
That's kind of picking you up that bad at the run level, I think.
Sure. Interesting thing.
Create a support ticket, and we'll get you an answer. Create a Bugzilla. All right. So last demo here, real quick. We'll do the bouncy balls demo. Some of you may have seen this before, some of you not. But this gives you an example of CPU resource restrictions. So I'm going to service CG. Okay, so now if I do an ls C groups, okay, those are all mounted. Forgot. All right, this is going to get really interesting once I try to do this because the demo is not actually installed on that host. So the demo is installed on my primary machine that I'm working on here. All right. Service, C groups, CG config, restart. Okay, so doing everything by command is wonderful and great, and you know, it's like a good first step to start playing with the technology, but obviously you don't want to go into creating a lot of shell scripts and stuff to echo these things around. So the main config file is cgconfig.conf in Etsy. Looks something like this. The idea is you basically, well, of course you can read the man page, but you mount up the subsystems that you plan to use. You create your group. So where I say group 1, group 2, this is basically where I said test 01 and test 02. You can also then further define, like, to do task manipulation within the C group. You can identify like an administrative user, somebody who's non-root but yet can add and remove tasks from the particular C group. And then, of course, there's the administrative user that can, you know, manipulate things. I've got it set to me, but I'm just going to do everything as root today. Okay, then in CPU set, you define which CPUs you want to use. I define how many shares, so I just create an arbitrary value and say this is how many shares of CPUs, and then I can divide that up into the various C groups. Do that for my other group as well. So the group's already created, and so now all I'm going to do is run a couple of processes, and one of those is SM spray. Okay, so here's a command cg exec, which is basically control group's going to execute a command for me, but as it does that, it's going to bind it into my group 2 C group with the enabled subsystems of CPU, CPU set, and something called freezer, and I'll explain that in a minute. And the last parameter basically tells SM spray how many threads do I want it to run. And to make, you know, sharing CPUs interesting, you want to have multiple threads because I want to be able to saturate the machine to make, you know, otherwise, if you don't saturate the boxes, C groups really don't have much purpose. Because they set kind of a high water mark instead of a, you only get 10% even when the box isn't busy. Okay. You know what? I'm going to reduce the set of that. It's a little big. I think it's -G 200. Nope. All right. I don't have the
Did
new version.
Did you say C groups are only useful if you're doing your provisioning badly?
What's that? If you're provisioning poorly, like in VMware or something?
Or just putting too much. If you're putting 50 pounds of shit in a 20-pound sack, then C groups are useful. Seems to be what you just said. It's only useful if you're hitting the wall.
Right. So your C groups won't starve a task unless there's other tasks that are waiting for that same resource. So you're not going to, if you're running a single HTTP server that doesn't have to share a system, there's no point to a C group. If you have five C groups, or five tasks, and they're sharing the same C group, but none of those tasks is saturating the machine, then you're still not really benefiting from the C group. Where the C group is interesting is, you know, you've got a limited amount of resources, and you want to guarantee that one thing won't starve the other. And this will actually prove the point here very well.
If one of them's hitting the wall, or collectively they'll add up to more than you've got, then this determines what the fair allocation is.
Yes.
So this is for CPU, that it's a soft limit, not a hard limit.
Yes.
Whereas in the I/O control, it was clearly a hard limit. Nothing else, well, no other I/O was going in your machine, but you were still limited to the throughput that you specified.
In those particular parameters, right. That was the IOPS.
So
right.
Some of them are hard and some of them are soft.
Is that fair?
Yeah, and with CPU, you have both.
You can do both.
You can do want to throttle someone, you can throttle them. Yes, I mean, each C group, memory is kind of a weird one because you can't take memory away from somebody other than killing them.
Right.
So you can say memory is usually a hot limit. And what happens when that processing is a hot limit, then they'll start swapping.
Sure.
Also, who killed them?
All right, so real quick, this won't take but a second. I'm using a small command line utility called cgbuddy. This is only an application somebody within Red Hat wrote to basically demonstrate how libc group would work. And so here I'm basically showing the CPU shares allocated to group one and group two, the CPUs that are part, and then of course this thing called the freezer state. Now freezer is actually interesting because I can click one and now I can identify, and you'll see that the other one obviously picks up right away. So just by freezing one process, the other process gets to use the available CPU capacity. So unfreeze him. I can divide his CPU shares in half. So now everybody's running at about bouncing between 17 and 20 hertz. Divide his resources down, and now the other guy benefits, right? So the other one picks up a little bit more. If I further remove his CPU shares, I can really make it painful. I can remove him and basically only give him one core now. So now it gets really competing, because he's sharing the same core. He's getting 512 shares, where the other guy is really getting more resources. So the math gets kind of fuzzy, and frees him. And now he's benefiting from the single core if I give him back the full cores. Now we're good. All right, demonstrating CPU shares. Everybody cool? All right, let's talk about containers. Dan? Yeah.
Can you do it on the GPU too?
Can we do what?
Can you do it on the GPU?
GPU.
Can you parachute the GPU resources too?
GPUs?
No.
Yeah. No. Not with C groups.
It's an idea for the future.
That's what the community is for.
Does anybody know if the sound actually works by plugging in?
It does in some rooms.
That's the first time I've heard sound.
I think we've just moved here.
The only advice I have, don't push on that end of the table or sit on it.
It's afraid to go over.
It's not afraid it'll go over. It does go over.
Jerry did.
I think I ran into that the last time I was in here when Brian had a meeting.
This is the virtual copy test.
Yeah.
Yeah, RHEL 7 doesn't hide the password. Made
you look!
It'd be real weird since this is Rawhide, so it wouldn't be RHEL 7. Let me get this thing duplicated.
But I locked myself out today. I started to change my user ID and then got distracted. Oops. So my user ID got changed, but not the shadow.
Oop. Yeah, that's good.
Rescue disk comes in handy.
Okay, a couple of. Most of what he was showing was on RHEL 6. And in RHEL 6, in order to use cgroups, you really have to, you have to go and do the work that he was doing. In RHEL 7, systemd, which is the new init system, will actually automatically put all processes into cgroups, and all processes will be based on what's called a fair share algorithm, especially towards CPU. That means that out of the box, every service will have its own cgroup, every user will have its own C group, every virtual machine will have their own C group, and each one of those C groups gets equal share of the operating system. So if you have a user that goes into his, logs into his system and forks off 1,000 processes, he won't get 1/1,000th of the system, a huge portion of his processes won't get a huge portion of the system. He'll still get only one cut of what the users get on the system. So
our systems, it's a sheet.
It's interesting, in RHEL 7, everybody, you're going to be in C groups all the time. Okay. Matter of fact, if you're running Fedora 20, 21, if you went and looked, all your processes are running inside of C groups. Okay. They're not constrained C groups. We weren't setting up any of the constraints that he was showing there, but they're constrained in that each one of them gets the equal slice of the system. So there's no way a process can run off and take over the system by default. So the other thing he talked about was containers. So for the last year and a half, I was working on the thing he was talking about, the LXC stuff, libvirt LXC, and we were designing a product called Vert Sandbox. And what Vert Sandbox's idea was to carve out individual parts of the take your slash user and make that sort of read-only into containers, and then make slash var be container specific. And we were looking at allowing you to run multiple Apache servers, MySQL, stuff like that. What happened, though, is Docker came along. Now, how many of you heard of Docker before today? Okay. So Docker was, let me go through. I'm going to put up some slides that you guys shouldn't see, but don't tell anybody I showed them to you, right?
Small enough, and the video recorder will be able to pick it up.
Yeah. So it says down here that this is, you guys all signed the NDA, right? So, but actually, the slides I'm going to show you have been made in public, and I don't know, I'd like to stretch the rules anyways. So, Docker, so we were working on our stuff, and very happy, thinking, oh, this is really cool stuff. And this company, .cloud, who was actually a competitor against OpenShift, which is Red Hat's version of PaaS, and actually we kind of killed their PaaS server. OpenShift is way more popular than their PaaS server. But when they were building their PaaS server, they developed this technology called Docker. And they started working on it last January. And then in March, they released it as an open source package. And it became the most popular package on GitHub. So it had 10,415 stars on it, which means 10,000 people went in and said, that looks great. It's also had 1,600 forks. That means people that are trying to actually build, look at the software and actually add contributions. And out of those, they've had 362 different people have contributed to the software, including many Red Hat people. So there's massive community interest in this. All the big players in the universe are looking at this, and this is like 25 guys in California are working on this. So they're going to be very, very rich. So one of the things that they talk about, their analogy comes from looking at the shipping industry pre-1960. And before 1960, when you wanted to ship something, you had to worry about things like putting your fragile stuff next to stuff that's heavy, putting your food sources next to potentially hazardous waste. And you had all these different worries that you had to do in shipping. So on the right-hand side is actually people that wanted to ship product. On the left-hand side is actually the shipping companies. So the problem with the shipping companies is trying to load and get as much stuff onto a shipping vessel as quickly as possible with all different sizes of products became, was a real hassle for them. So the whole shipping industry was rather in bad shapes pre-1960. After that came, and after the 1960s, they standardized on a container. Okay, so the shipping container became the standardized mechanism for shipping, and a user or a person that wants to ship something now only has to worry about sticking his stuff inside of this standardized container. Shippers, all they have to worry about is how to quickly load these containers onto their ships and build their ships around the standards. So you want to fit as many of these things onto your ship as possible. So through the standardization of shippers, that's where the algorithm, that's where the idea of Docker comes from, and that's why you'll see the whale with the containers on his back. The interesting thing is in the software industry, we really have the same problem. So we have developers that want to build tools, want to build their applications. They want to code, they want to build libraries, they want to test in one location, and they want to set up their configuration, potentially their data all inside of their application stack. And then you have the people running the operating systems, the sysadmins out there, and what do they care about? They care about setting up the operating system, getting many applications running in as possible. They want to start and stop the applications or containers. They want to do logging, see what these applications are doing and monitoring them. And they want to usually configure like networks, set up networks for these applications. So you really have sort of a similar dichotomy that you had pre-1960 for the shipping industry. We actually have it in the software industry now. So in developers, what the developers can do in a Docker environment is start to take advantage of an image-based system. at this point, people should be starting to think of this as bundling. Okay, so this is bundling the operating system or the parts of the operating system that you need for your application to run can be bundled together, and then you can just ship that. So what does that do for the developer? He can test one environment. He can test his image on top of, gives him application mobility. The application is fully integrated into the operating system, and he allows to run his application on multiple different servers. So think of, you have a RHEL 7 box coming out and you want to run a RHEL 6 application on top of it. So what does he tell your developers? Oh, you got to port your application to RHEL 6. In a container environment, you might be able to bring the entire RHEL 6 runtime environment, including the application, onto your RHEL 7 box and run it. Might even be able to do it with RHEL 5. You can do it with Ubuntu. You can bring Ubuntu applications onto a RHEL box, similar type thing. So that the idea here is that the entire user space with the application will ship. So it's not only containers, but it's this whole idea of the bundling of the user space with the application. On the administrator's point of view, he now can bring these applications in and he can do things like he doesn't have to worry about patching as much, because the applications are going to bring a very small part, very small subsection of the user space. So if the container doesn't use SSHD and SSHD has a vulnerability in it, you don't have to worry about updating the application inside the container. So you might potentially have less patching in this type of environment, and you can get greater application density. So with containers, you can run application density as compared to virtualization. So problem with full virtualization is you're virtualizing an operating system. In a lot of cases, people wanted to use virtualization because they want to run two Apache servers on a box at a time. So would you rather just manage two Apache application stacks, or would you rather manage two operating systems and have all the overhead of managing two operating systems? So we're going to look a little deeper at what Docker brings to the table. Docker has this idea of an image or a base image. In Red Hat's case, we're looking to ship RHEL 7 base images, RHEL 6 base images, potentially RHEL 5 base images. And these are really sort of read-only images that you very small, potentially as small as just having bin shell, the glibs, and maybe some core utilities, and that's about it. That's really the goal here is to get these things to be as small as possible. And then you want to run a container on top of it. So when you install a Docker image, that is a piece of, that's all the software, but it's not running. When you run it, it's called a container. So when I'm running a writable container process inside of my, on top of my image, that basically can go off and do anything it wants in the environment, inside of the container environment. When you exit out of it, the application goes away. So you can, by default, you can have the application be destroyed. And then you can start to build up layered images. So in this case, we've just added two more layers to the image stack. We've added an Apache daemon to the image, and then we've added JBoss on top of that. And now we're running a full containerized environment that's running JBoss on top of Apache, on top of a RHEL 7 system. If you run this environment and update it, and you want to stop it, you can actually create a new image based on the whole layers here. So if you went into one of these containers and did a yum update to add additional software to it, and then say went outside of it and did a Docker save, you would create a new image that you can then run. So the actual Docker commands, I'm going to do a little bit of a demonstration for you in a minute. You can run, just to run a Docker command, hello world, you can say Docker run, and then pick the operating system you want to run it on, or the container you want to run it on, RHEL 7, and then just echo hello world. After you run that, when you run that command, even if you don't have the RHEL 7 image installed in your box, it'll go out to a repository and bring the image onto your machine. So we can go out and find images in the environment and pull it in, and then it'll run hello world, exit the container, and you'll be done. If you want to just pull, say, a RHEL 6 image, you should be able to do that when we ship this thing. You should be able to pull the image in and then be allowed to run it in later times. If you wanted to list all the images, you can just do a Docker images, and you can see sort of the output here of different images that are available.
What's unique about the like the RHEL 7 and RHEL 6 images? It's just the operating system that's gone through the process of somebody building the container.
Right. So I mean, when Red Hat talks about it, what we're trying to do is we are going through a strict build process to create these images that you will allow, you know, if you have a RHEL subscription, you'll be able to get RHEL images to run in your box. And then we also have a higher level that we're going to have certified applications. So currently you'd have a certified application that would be available via RPM or from a customer that's certified to run on a RHEL system. Now there'll be certified images that you can then get and run in your RHEL system.
Will those containers have their own kernel images, or they just share?
No, kernel. The whole thing about containers is you're sharing the host kernel. So it brings up an interesting point. You know, the real in the strictest containerized environment, the only thing you rely on is the host kernel. So you could have an API. The only thing you really rely on is the API to the kernel. Everything you would bring everything along with you. As we look at doing some of the work we're doing right now is around plumbing. Because most people don't want just a strict image. What they want is sort of some stuff leaking in, like syslog. Right? You want to have your syslog messages come out of the container and go into your journaling system. You might want to have identity provided to the. You might want to set up identity on your host and then have identity leaked into the container, so container would have the same, you know, same users and stuff like that. So there are different things that you want to plumb into the containers, but in a strict case, the container just relies on the API of the kernel.
That you can have whatever set of shared libraries you want that happens to...
Right, you don't even have to. You could, as I said, you can run Ubuntu, Fedora, RHEL 6, anything. You bring your own library, everything with you. You can't run Windows in these things.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So it has to be a Linux. It has to be something that can talk to the Linux kernel.
Right.
And if you do like heavy multimedia... something that used to rely on a RHEL 5 and using the old FireWire stack, but you've got the new kernel that doesn't have that, you're not going to be able to cross that.
Yeah, if the API at the kernel level has actually changed.
Right. So it's an interesting problem because, you know, I can see, I think you're usually going to want the latest kernel and then use a older
set of libraries.
Libraries on top of it, as opposed to trying to run RHEL 7 on a RHEL 5 operating system, right?
Yeah.
So. But theoretically, as long as the API, as long as you are only using the parts of the kernel API that was available, you should be able to do that. So that we just covered really base images, and we talked a little bit about layered images. Docker also has this concept of what's called a Docker file. And what a Docker file is actually a script that can allow you to build these layered images. And it's a really fairly simple. So if you said, here I have an example of from RHEL 7, that tells this image you're building that it's going to have a base image of RHEL 7. Then you can run the yum install inside of your container, or inside of your build, and that would, in this case, we're installing MongoDB on top of the base image. Then you were asking about the networking configuration inside of the container. I can say I'm going to only expose one port to the network. So in this case, we're exposing port 2707. Volume tells it to actually mount the host operating system directory into the container. So in a lot of cases, you run a container, you really don't want any data that you're writing to sit inside the container. You want it sort of on a shared, on the host file system. So this would basically say, I'm going to put the database into /datadb, and that would mount datadb off of the host into the container, bind mounted in.
So that's the namespace of the root.
Right, it's a directory from the root. It's in your namespace, but when you have a mount namespace, that just means your mount table is going to look different than the host mount table.
That's a real cheroot.
Yeah. So this would be like a cheroot, and then you bind mount it in this directory on top of it. And then the last one is actually a command to run. So you can, after you get if I just did a Docker start of this container I'm building, it would run that command at the end. And that's where you get to the one command per container. So that, again, this is sort of standard Docker. To build it, it's a fairly simple API to do Docker build dash T. So you're naming it my Mongo dot. When it's done, if you did a start of that image, it would run that container. Now, someone else that comes along sees this thing and says, that's really cool. I'd like to use that in my image. He'd be able to build another Docker file that then could say from my Mongo, you know, add additional stuff. And that's how you build up the layers. When you're using it too, the image is shared, so you're not duplicating all the software on your disk. So they're all going to share the same base image as you build these things up.
If my Mongo commits something in whose image at all, if I used it, it appears in mine. If I lay it on top of him.
No, I mean, my Mongo is the read-only image. Anything he's running is in the container.
Okay,
so when you're running your container, you have the ability to save your container, but you're not going to create a My Mongo.
Okay,
you're going to create a new thing.
Got it.
Okay. And that's no matter what. Now, he could, if he based off of My Mongo, when you go and save a new version of My Mongo, he will still be based on your old version of My Mongo.
Okay.
Now, if he does a Docker build again, he will get your new version. So like when we're shipping RHEL 7, so when we update the base image, you would have to go out to your images that were based on it and rebuild them, Docker build them again.
Each image also contains metadata, right?
That describes
what the service will look like when it runs.
Right.
So besides just the data and the operating system and the application, it wraps additional data so that when the Docker gets launched, there's configurable parameters. So you can take the same image and run it 100 times with 100 different parameters and have different host names and IPs and all this stuff, so that
right.
basically one image can be deployed in different ways.
Right. So other things that Docker provides.
Yeah, I have a question about that.
Oh.
Sorry.
Container itself share the same entry pool, the random number generation?
They're going to have devrandom and devurand mounted into the containers that's from the host.
Would there be an issue with that? Random entropy perhaps?
Yes. I mean, one way to look at it is that, I mean, you don't have to give them dev random if you don't want to. I mean, it's sort of your choice. But yeah, I mean, you could have them sucking up random dev random out of the system. But I mean, in ways, these are just additional services running on the system.
C group.
Yeah, you can C group.
Restrictive block trade.
One of the interesting things they also have is they have this idea of registries, and that's what, remember I said you could do a Docker run RHEL 7, even if you don't have the RHEL 7 image on your box, it will go out to a registry and actually grab a RHEL 7 off of the registry. So right now, if you ran Docker, say on your Fedora box or your Ubuntu box, it would go out to Docker.io, the company that's formed it, they have a huge registry, and you could get Ubuntu, CentOS, you know, everything but RHEL, because we don't allow RHEL to go up there. So in a RHEL environment, you can do Docker run RHEL, but you'll probably go out to your satellite server or to your CDN or even out to access.redhat.com and be able to get the images if you have a subscription. You can set up private registries, but also once you have this, you can also have the ability to push. So you build that MongoDB container and you want to push it up to the registry, you have the ability to push it up and then have other people in your company actually pull it down. Or you could use that as a distribution. So now you could set up, you would push it up to the registry, you would set up 10 servers, and each one of those servers would be just doing a Docker run, My Mongo, you know, with different configurations. And even if they didn't have My Mongo on it, they would, you know, when their first time they start up, they will suck it down to the box. You can name containers, and then you set up links, so you can actually link the containers together. We talked about that earlier, how you can hook up IP addresses and, I mean, that. Ports between them so that they have the ability to read and write it. So what Red Hat, where is Red Hat involved with this? So Red Hat, about 6 months ago, I don't have that slide in here. Actually, it's, there it is. So I was working on the libvirt sandbox, and all of a sudden we had people in Red Hat last summer come out and say, you know, we really need to look at this Docker thing. Docker's kind of, Docker's happening. And one of the nice things, one of the great things about Red Hat and great things about open source is that you like to fail early. like before RHEL 7 ships. So we quickly figured out that we were going down the wrong path, or at least we were going down the path where we had very few people behind us while there was train was going down the other track. So we decided to stop our losses and jump on the Docker bandwagon. So as of last September, we agreed to work with Docker and to start collaborating and try to make their product into what we consider enterprise ready. So we've been working with them. We've basically switched a lot of our engineering to working on Docker. And we've submitted many, many patches to Docker. One of the things Docker was working on was the AUFS, which is not in a, it actually was never put into the kernel. So we've written patches to that. Now Docker uses DevMapper that was provided by us. I personally added SE Linux support to Docker. We've have lots of other patches as we're trying to get it tied into C groups better. And Docker right now is at a 0.9 release. It's not released as a supported product out of Docker itself. They're hoping before RHEL 7 ships to have Docker 1.0 out. When RHEL 7 ships, we will be supporting Docker. Well, we will not support Docker. It will be a what we call a tech preview, mainly because we don't want to hook Docker up to the 10-year support cycle of RHEL. The reason for that is it's brand new software, and we don't want to be, you know, 3 years from now people saying, I know everybody has this really great Docker, but I want that Docker that you shipped when RHEL 7 came out, so we're not going to support it for the 10-year life cycle, but it will be supported at some point when we feel it's up to the quality. So going back down. One of the things that you, when you use Docker, you have to think about, if you notice this Rolex has two X's in the name, who are you going to trust? You know, when you're looking at this software, you really have to start thinking about, what am I installing on my box? When one of my fellow engineers say Docker is great, it's all about people going out and getting random pieces of software and then running them as root on their host operating system. So you have to start thinking about, what's in these things. And so that's really where Red Hat, that's our goal, is to make Red Hat sort of the choice platform for doing this. In some ways, this new imaging system is going to be a new way of distributing software. And if you think back before RHEL came out back in, say, the year 2000, the way people distributed software on the internet was all sort of you go out to random websites and suck software into your box and you do a make install. Or you might get an RPM somewhere, and you ended up with these sort of weird environments that really could not be supported in the enterprise. So you couldn't even set up 50,000 of these boxes like most of the big banks are doing now. So you really needed a standardized software stack, and that's really that's one of the reasons Red Hat's concentrating on it. But that's enough. Let me just show you a couple of the interesting things that we're working on here. So in RHEL 7, systemd has the ability to set, you're showing you all these tools that are available in RHEL 6 for setting up systemd, setting up C groups. In RHEL 7, systemd, which is the new NIT system, has a new format for what's called unit files. It's replacing sort of standard sysinit scripts. And in a unit file, you describe what the application server is going to run. And you can actually put resource or C group configuration into your unit file. So this says here on the right hand, Apache container service tells it to run command and want to do in a doc start of a RHEL 7 Apache container. And then it says a memory limit of 500K. So basically I've said that I want to run this application on my box, but I don't want the processes inside of it to have no more than half a gigabyte of memory. So systemd then would launch Docker, and Docker would launch the container, and the processes inside of the container would not be allowed to exceed 500K. Another interesting thing from systemd is the idea of what's called socket activation. What socket activation allows you to do is to set up lots and lots of services on your system, but not have them actually run until a packet arrives for the service to run. So in this case, we've set up an Apache environment that says, I want systemd to listen on port 80. If any connections come in for port 80, then launch the container. The container gets launched, and systemd would actually push the connection to port 80 down to the Apache server, and the Apache server then would process it. This gives you the higher footprinter. You can put more and more services onto machines with this type of environment.
Oh, one question I have is on sockets, they're usually timeouts at the other end. Would that be able to start that service in time to respond to?
Yeah, let me show you how quickly a container starts up.
Okay. Containers start as fast as the process.
Yes.
For the most part.
So here we have, hopefully this works. Actually, I'm not going to show that one right now. So. That's it, container started up. So if I exit out, so here it shows you all the processes on the system. Let's see, now I'm gonna go into the container. So I just started another container. Now you see all the processes on the container. So if you see here, one of the things we talked about earlier is namespaces, and I said that process namespace changes. So in this container now, all it sees is two processes running. I happen to run bin shell as the process inside the container, and now it sees that there's only, that's my init system. So if you see, this is PID 1. If I went outside the container now, that process is actually visible on the host operating system, and but it's not PID 1, it's PID 3000 or something. So there's a different view of the operating system. If I went and looked at, say, slash, cat, Betsy, release, you'll see that this is running as Fedora 20, Heisenberg. If I did a cat, a Betsy Red Hat release outside of the, you'll see that I'm running Rawhide. So that shows that I'm running two different versions of Fedora. If I went, this is where I'm gonna, so I don't have CentOS installed in my box. So right now it's going out and it's actually pulling down CentOS, and hopefully the MIT network doesn't throttle me in a second. So it's actually going out to the Docker.io site right now and actually pulling down CentOS onto the box. And when that finishes...
About how big are these?
The goal is to make them as small as possible.
Yeah.
And
how possible is it?
The base image that we built for RHEL using standard tools was about 500 meg. I built a base image using a couple of tricks and got it down to 100 meg. So and that's in a, the image I'm talking about is an Apache image, so it runs Apache inside of it. It's funny, as we've most of the tools used to build these things, standard things for installing operating systems like Anaconda, and so you have lots of things that want to put the kernel inside of these things, and we don't want the kernel. But Node uses up the most space on these images, languages, translation languages. So if it, you know, I always just wish that, you know, everybody just spoke English, because that's the only language I can speak. You know, perhaps I'm a little. So we've actually built tools. I have a tool with the yum. I can do a yum install. You can do yum install root of HTTPD. If you just do that, just Apache, you will get an image that's 400 megabytes. If you give it two flags that say just install English, it'll go down to 200 megabytes. Then there's a glibc, which comes with this big bundled library of languages. Of all languages, and you can go into that and eliminate all languages but English, and you can get it down to 100 megabytes. But that's a Apache server without the kernel and stuff. So that's about as it's starting to get about as small as possible. You can get, theoretically, you can get smaller, but when you're managing these, I don't know if it's probably not a given. Usually, this takes on a full network like 10 seconds, but. The last time I tried this, MIT kicked me off, so they might not like me.
On a Debian system, I think I can't remember the name. I think it might have been a Dev Bootstrap. Will generate a file tree which is nominally a version. Oh no, you got it. Nominally a Debian system, and I seem to recall it was smaller than.
Yeah, I mean, you can do a there's a BusyBox, one of these, that's very, very small. The question, you know, if you get too small, now I go in to do any type of debugging in it, and I don't have, you know, core utilities. I don't have LS. You know, it's like, okay, you know. So the thing is, once you've got it on your box, you know, once you have Fedora on the box, you're not sucking it down again, right? So it's just the one time, you get the one time hit. Yep. Yes.
You just showed us systemd starting up a container.
Right.
When there was traffic on port 80. Is there any kind of way that you shut down a container?
Well,
there's no activity.
I work a lot with the OpenShift guys, and they're... everybody here know what OpenShift is? A couple of people know what OpenShift is. If you go to OpenShift.com right now, you can get an account and you can have a shell on the internet, full, and you can basically start to build applications for free. Okay, so we've had OpenShift out to PaaS server, so platform as a service. It's been out for I think about 3 or 4 years, and we actually, I don't know what the current numbers are, but it's in the hundreds of thousands of users. Okay, and all these people are using it for free. It's actually running on EC2. It's a bunch of VMs running hundreds of thousands of these containerized environments out on the internet. And I've lost your question. I'm talking too much.
Shutting down,
yes, okay. So, so one of the things here is they don't want, if you have 150,000 or 200,000, 300,000, whatever 1,000 users on it, each one of them are building little Apache web servers that they're going to run their little CGI or PHP or more powerful menus for restaurants. You really want to kill these things when they're not running, right? So what OpenShift has done is they've actually built up algorithms that watch IP tables for packet throughput, and over a certain period of time, if you don't have packets coming into your containerized process, they will kill it. So systemd in RHEL 7 has the ability to say, I'm going to run this process for so long, but it's really not, it doesn't have the heuristics of knowing whether or not it's killing it. So systemd has the ability to auto start applications and to have them time out. So what we're looking at is using OpenShift's technology that's been watching these processes and figuring out whether or not they're having any network traffic and then killing them. So potentially we're going to pull that into a Docker-type environment that allow you optionally to say, if this thing is not getting any packets for 10 seconds, then you can kill it. But it's a hard problem, right? If you're running a database in there that's doing tons and tons of number crunching, you really don't want to kill it because I got no network traffic. So so anyways, that failed miserably. Just never do a demo, or at least a demo that relies on networking at a college that doesn't want to hand out his stuff. So anyways, that gives you some idea of what Docker is. And as I said, we're really hot on it. It's almost as big a change to the computing industry as VMs were, say, 5, 10 years ago. So if you remember Linux before, when Zen was first coming out 6, 7, 8 years ago, this is another, I think, a leap in technology that is going to quickly become important. So.
Okay. Thank you, Dan.
Yep.
And thank you, Christoph. Okay, let me have a show of hands of those who are going to the brewery. Okay, I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, I think. Steve, are you going?
No, I'm not.
No, okay. So we've got 6. Who's walking?
It's actually not that far from here.
What? It's about a 10-minute walk. So Shankar, myself, Bill Ricker are walking. Christoph is walking with us. I got to start with my car to drop stuff off.
One note for walking. There are rainstorms inbound on our
Oh, there it is. This is the extension.